pay. I say tomorrow matters. Yes, it does.
Tomorrow matters.
Really does.
Tomorrow matters.
Tomorrow matters today.
KRXA, this is Tomorrow Matters, talk radio for a better tomorrow, the location on the West Coast for environmentally conscious connection. I'm Deborah Lindsay, host of Tomorrow Matters. Thank you for joining me this afternoon. Climate change, what can be done about it? Well, some folks are just plain confused and maybe feel insignificant when it comes to action, but our guest today is one of those people that, in fact, feels very motivated to change and helping others as well. He is Chuck Tremper, author of As the Oceans Rise, Meeting the Challenges of Global Warming, and he's local, which I love. He's based out of Santa Cruz. He's working at Ecology Action, which you might remember we had Molly Ober on last week. But Chuck is on the phone with us today, and he's ready to talk all things possible. Welcome, Chuck. Thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you so much, Deborah. I'm very pleased to be here.
Can you hear me okay?
Just great.
Okay, so tell us about your book, As Oceans Rise. Give us an outline. Tell us about it.
Sure. The book really breaks into two parts. So first, setting it up, going through the evidence regarding climate change and the role that human behavior and activity has played in causing the climate to change already,
mm-hmm.
and is likely to cause it to change even more dramatically in the year, depending on what we choose to do about it.
Mm-hmm.
It also lays out some of the psychological bases for our behavior and bringing ourselves to change, because unlike many of the, I call, Save the Planet books, this one acknowledges that just changing our behavior isn't all that easy.
Mm-hmm.
It's one thing to say, go change your light bulbs. It's another to completely change your lifestyle as may be necessary to bring our carbon emissions in line with what the atmosphere can absorb. This is going to be a really big deal process, quite unlike anything we've been through previously. So talking about how psychologically we bring ourselves to live different lives than we have in the past gets a lot of attention in the book.
Right.
Go on. I was going to say the second half then says, yeah, but we can do it. And in fact, here's dozens of examples of people living more sustainably, local governments that are taking action, green tech businesses, organizations that are trying to help the environment and endangered species to adapt and survive climate change, like WWF and the Nature Conservancy. So it's just chock full of examples and inspiration of what people and entities are already doing.
Mm-hmm. Well, what I really like just in the title itself is not if the oceans rise. I mean, it's really saying, no, folks, this is happening. Okay, whether or not you want to believe it or not, it is, and we have to start from that place and work forward. And I like that, because many books still place it in context of, you know, well, let's just ease into this a little bit. And you're saying, we're here and we've got to change. And you must have done that purposely.
Yes, I did indeed. And it's a great dilemma, mm-hmm. among people who are concerned about climate change to strike that right balance between scaring the wits out of everybody over, right. well, the world is coming to an end, and gee, haven't we heard that before?
Right.
But it really is.
Right.
And if we wait, one of the key points in the book I hope we'll be able to get back to through the program is the concept of tipping points and cycles and feedback loops, and how we're these feedback loops have tipping points past which the option will no longer be there, no matter what we do,
mm-hmm.
of stopping a course under which the planet gets warmer and warmer beyond any limits that we would prefer to endure. And we're not going to know exactly where those tipping points are until it's too late. Some have conjectured we may already be passing critical tipping points. We'll talk more about that. But yes, it is a time for large. It's on the one hand, we've got an Al Gore and people aligned with his view, James Hansen at NASA and others, saying this is a climate emergency, but at the same time, we're not acting the least bit like it's an emergency. We're acting like, oh, well, they say we've got 10 years to do something. I'll worry about it in 9.
Well, and so there we are, right? I mean, that is not a long time. 9, 10 years is really nothing when we're talking about completely shifting the way that we perceive how we live on this planet. And this is what you mean about the psychological hang-ups, which you mentioned in your book. You have a whole chapter about that. Tell me, what do you mean? What are our psychological hang-ups?
Well, we're very much change resistant as human beings. It's our nature. It has served us well over time, and evolutionarily, like, you know, other species, we've been around and adapted slowly to slowly changing conditions. It's just within the last few hundred years that we've gone off on a very different trajectory as human beings in terms of the rate of change of primarily because of technology, but social institutions as well, at just unprecedented rates that are completely out of sync with the rate of natural changes.
Right.
And so our psychology, our long-formed mental processing, is lagging behind what we need to have to, you know, change overnight into different kinds of people with different kinds of priorities, and what it will ultimately take, a different concept of what is the good life and how might we achieve satisfaction in a way that places much fewer demands on the planet's capacity to support us.
Right.
So I talk in there about something called cognitive dissonance, which is this what arises in our minds when we have inconsistent beliefs and knowledge or information. So on the one hand, we have this information that our behavior, the way we're living, is causing irreversible, catastrophic damage to the climate. And at the same time, we like the way we're living.
Mm-hmm.
We don't really want to change, certainly not quickly. And so this conflict develops. And the chapter you're referring to talks about, well, how can we work through that and expedite the process of bringing our actions into alignment with what we now understand to be the need to change.
Well, just give me a little, I mean, what is it that we have to do?
Well,
in you know, 2 minutes.
Sure. The alternate title of the book that I played with was Just Change Everything,
mm-hmm.
which, of course, is another one of those big, scary, well, we can't do that, and perhaps paralyzing or immobilizing. I can't do that. Give me something I can do today.
Right.
And opportunities abound. It's important, of course, to note that it's not just what we do as individuals. Of course, government has to change, industry has to change, but government and industry respond to what we prefer as individuals. So ultimately, it's about us. We also influence others, which is a key point in the book when we talk about, well, why should we change when maybe China and India, they aren't going to change anyway. Well, the rest of the world looks to the United States for leadership, looks at our behaviors, our consumption. So one thing for sure is if we don't change, they won't change.
Right.
But if we do, there is some opportunity for leadership to change the behavior of others. What people do depends greatly on what they perceive others doing,
right,
as opposed to just, you know, dry knowledge about maybe what they ought to be doing. So back to make it real concrete and simple, what we drive, how far we drive, what we eat is key. And changing to eating lower on the food chain, much less beef in the diet, these are things we can start doing this afternoon.
Right. Well, you know, it's interesting. I get a lot of questions about, you know, if I don't use that gallon of gas, somebody in China is going to use that gallon of gas. And so why not use it? And what's your response to something like that?
The most important thing to keep in mind there is that climate change isn't an all-or-nothing proposition. It isn't this one wall we're going to hit one day and, okay, we blew it, we're over it, or we stayed on this side and we're not.
Mm-hmm.
It's an incremental and additive process. So it's not quite the case that if we don't use that gallon of gas, somebody else will. In fact, if we cut our consumption, it will make a difference in how quickly carbon is being added to the atmosphere, and therefore how long we have to continue making changes and convincing others to make changes so that we can avoid the most dramatic and adverse effects of climate change. We're trying to buy time right now, and every reduction of carbon emissions that we can achieve buys just a little bit more time from each person, each country. It's all cumulative.
Right. Good response. I'm going to have to remember that when I get asked that question. Thank you. Listen, we're going to take a very quick break. This is Deborah Lindsay on KRXA, Tomorrow Matters. And my guest this afternoon is Chuck Tremper, who is from Santa Cruz, author of As the Oceans Rise, Meeting the Challenges of Global Warming. If you'd like to call in and ask a question about this book or any of the material that we're covering right now, please do give us a call, 899-5792 or toll free 888-5792-540. We will be right back after this message. And we are back. This is Deborah Lindsay on KRXA Tomorrow Matters. The number here, if you'd like to call in, 899-KRXA. My guest this afternoon, Chuck Tremper, and we're talking about climate change. And Chuck, I am really interested in this the psycho hang-ups that we have, that the barriers to which we're not making the changes. And you have a five-step path to action. Can you tell me, can you talk about that?
I'd love to, Deborah. Thanks for asking. And so what we're talking about here is how we change our behavior, in essence, how we change ourselves, how we deal with having been confronted with what amounts to terrible news. The lives we've been leading, as Frank Zappa once said, it's got to go.
Mm-hmm.
That we need to make these deep fundamental changes. So I taught in a psychology department some years ago at the University of Nebraska, and drawing upon the work of my colleagues there on change management, behavioral change, harken back to the work that you may recognize of Elizabeth Kubler-Ross,
mm-hmm.
who brought us, popularized the notion of the five stages of dealing with grief, which she originally had titled the five stages of dealing with catastrophic news. It was the news of, you know, you're dying. And recognize that the steps of that process transform pretty well into all kinds of behavioral change processes, and laid it out specifically in the book for dealing with this news of global warming and its implications for our lives, and said, oh, well, at the first stage, we certainly need to achieve awareness, which has been getting pounded into our heads through the media in the past couple of years, that yes, there is climate change. It is occurring. That's unequivocal. It's not a future prediction. We can talk about how bad it's going to get, but it's been happening now for some time. Once we became aware of the change itself, there's also then, well, what can we do about it? A second stage of awareness that, yes, human activity contributes to that change, and these specific activities matter most, such things as driving and home heating and electricity use, anything that's using fossil fuels, which release immense amounts of carbon into the atmosphere. So you get to that, and the natural, normative, normal psychological process of being confronted with bad news is to doubt. You know, stage two,
right.
You're into, that doesn't sound right to me. The planet's a big place. And, you know, my little gas isn't making any difference. Blah, blah.
It's self-regulating. How could we possibly do anything?
Mm-hmm. Climate change has occurred over millions of years. The Earth's been hotter. It's been cooler. I just don't believe this.
Right.
Okay. You need to get beyond that. And that's one reason that willingly listening to shows like this and reading books and magazines and paying attention to all this climate change information is critical, because pretty much you've got to overwhelm your built-in doubt that says, you know, as long as I doubt this, as long as I don't believe it, I don't have to act upon it.
Right.
So that's quite a challenge. It's very deep-seated. It doesn't want to let go.
Mm-hmm.
And that leads you into the third stage of cognitive dissonance, the psychological term, or simply internal conflict, you've now got a battle going on within your own head. Here's this information that you're starting to believe is increasingly credible. But if you believe it, then that's going to create an imperative that you do things that you don't want to do. You give up things that you don't want to give up. You change in ways that you hadn't thought you would need to change in. So this process goes on, and the mind has all kinds of mechanisms to try to avoid changing, confronting and accepting the reality. But if we get to that fourth step, that's where acceptance occurs, and you said, well, I should be doing something. If you've gotten to that, I should change the light bulbs but haven't gotten around to it, I want to buy a Prius, that's where you are. You're at acceptance. One step short of getting to action,
mm-hmm.
and actually picking up and moving on. And that's where a number of things can help, one of which is associating with other people who are similarly minded and are taking action and are creating new social norms that say, wow, vegetarian diet, good for you.
Mm-hmm. Right, you know, right.
Much as we change from thinking one for the road was a great idea to you must be kidding.
Right.
You know, the same thing can happen around behaviors that we now consider perfectly normal, like having a steak dinner, to thinking, no, alternatives might be even better. Eating locally grown foods, driving less, bicycling, you know, all the different ways of living that have such a reduced carbon impact and give us the prospect of a planet we would like to live on for years and generations ahead.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you go through each piece and talk about what is actually driving one person from stage one to stage two to stage two to stage three, or do you really work on that last piece about how to make it more of a cultural norm that we're doing these actions?
Yeah, that's where the emphasis goes. I think people mm-hmm. can pretty easily see themselves along the way.
Right.
And that chapter concludes with suggestions for helping others move along the path and thereby being part of the creation of new cultural norms, new ways of conceptualizing the good life.
Right.
And what we want out of it.
So what does the good life look like?
Good life, there's an interesting quote in the book from George Blumenthal, the new chancellor of the University of California, Santa Cruz. He was talking about his deep commitment to reducing carbon emissions at the university. And he was saying, now we're going to roll our emissions back to 1990 levels, and then we're going to roll them all the way back to 1700. And that got him big applause at the among the students he was addressing. And I thought about that afterward and thought, well, in 1700, that was a big redwood forest sitting there.
Yeah.
It didn't look a whole lot like a university campus. And it brought home for me, it's like, well, how would you really do that? What would we need to look like? Well, in some respects, we need to look a lot more like we were in 1700 than we are in 2008. We would undoubtedly be very, very different. We would have many of the technological marvels we have today powered by renewable resources, but not the same level of consumer goods, travel, activities, technologies that we do today, because the planet won't support it. Ask yourself this question as a thought experiment for saying, is the way we're living, is the way I'm living sustainable? And that's to say, drawing on Immanuel Kant from the categorical imperative of philosophy, you know, what actions of yours could be universalized to all people, to say, is my lifestyle sustainable by this planet if an extra 3 billion people in the developing countries adopted that same lifestyle?
Mm-hmm.
And it's not at that point you realize, gee, it's not just about the amount of carbon it's putting into the air, it's the amount of resources that it takes to sustain that life cycle, the number of toxic materials, the number of just raw materials. Estimates say it would take 6 to 7 planet Earths to sustain the lifestyle of if the average American was copied over by
right.
everyone on the planet, and the population is rising.
Right.
So it just gets tougher. So yeah, we would live more simply, we would come to embrace more of the things that gave us pleasure and enjoyment, fulfillment, and happiness in 1700 than the things that we do value so highly today.
Okay, now there's the gist of the story, because, you know, we could look back and say, well, probably in the 1700s, things that people did were embroidery. You know, the women sat around and chatted and sewed and did quilting, and, you know, the men went out and whittled and bonded in you know, ways like such as that, as rolling logs around, or, you know, I don't know, you know, things that just seem so has been so last century. And as we're interested in more high tech and iPods and MySpace, and I mean, it's a hard sell, Chuck, you have to admit.
Absolutely. And, you know, what makes it a hard sell is that we have all this stuff right now.
Mm-hmm.
And this is another one of those games or tricks or just prophecies, if you want to be neutral, that our mind plays on us. It's very hard for our mind to imagine a future that's tremendously different from the one we have right now. And so we're kind of negotiating with nature here and saying, look, we'll have a future that's more or less like we do, but we'll have some more renewable energy, and technology will solve the rest of these problems somehow, so that I still have my iPod, and I still have MySpace, and I still have all this stuff.
Right.
But somehow it's got a lower carbon footprint.
Right.
Well, there's a simple saying of do the math, it doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we can't extend that. That doesn't mean that what we'll have instead is life just like it was in the 1700s. It's going to be some hybrid, to use a popular word,
mm-hmm.
but something that embraces more of what gave us satisfaction, not those particular activities necessarily of embroidery and whittling, but it may be that, well, take entertainment, for example.
Yeah.
Is it necessary that we go to a concert with 50,000 of our closest friends to be entertained by professionals who move from one city to another around the world, and that's part of the good life? Or is there something we can do, learning once more to each of us tap our musical talents, our artistic talents, and our storytelling talents, you know, things that have been lost and gone because we didn't need them anymore.
Mm-hmm.
We, you know, our reliance on cheap resources, cheap energy, allowed us to create a very different reality that we live in today, but it's not a sustainable reality.
Right. So what you're saying is that rather than going to the concert, we can create a talent show in our backyard with our neighbors, and that can be just as equally as entertaining, if not more satisfying, because there's depth to it and connection to it, than, you know, that are long lasting and will have repercussions, you know, as far as building community, than going to a concert, which is, you know, probably way overstimulating, very expensive, uses a huge carbon footprint, and ultimately will pass and be just something you attended and talk about in fleeting in the future, rather than something that connects you.
You said it much better than I can, and I'm sure there are listeners out there rolling their eyes right now and said, you've got to be kidding me. You know,
Well, no. I mean, I'm sure there are, but I mean, these are definitely things that, that I work on just like everybody else, you know? So, listen, Chuck, we've got to take another break. This is Deborah Lindsay on KRXA, Tomorrow Matters. And my guest today is Chuck Tremper, who is the author of As the Ocean Rises, and we would love to hear from you. Give us a call. What is the activity that you're going to do to create community in your area? We'd love to hear about it and make suggestions. My listeners want to hear. What are we going to do? 899-KRXA, toll free, 888-579-2540. Give us a call. My guest this afternoon, Chuck Tremper, and we are talking about climate change on, you know, different paths of action. But Chuck, I'm really curious. We've been talking about green businesses. That's been on our plate a lot this past week, particularly. What do you think about green technology? Is it going to save us? Is technology going to save us? And how does that weave into the idea of green businesses?
Yeah, as far as what's going to save us, I'm reminded of a quote from Lara Hansen at WWF where she's saying we're past the point where we need to be talking about whether to do this or that. We're at the point where we have to be talking about doing this and that.
Okay.
And so in addition to what we've all been talking about so far, we have to have very different businesses going forward than we have in the past. Different businesses with different products, even different business models. A starting point is certainly around renewable energy sources. There's, if you're anywhere near Silicon Valley, as we are, well aware of all the startups that are trying to bring out products to harvest energy from the sun, from wind, from tidal power, from waves, hydropower. That's a whole new field that has tremendous potential not to hurt the economy, as some have argued against responding to global warming as just being too expensive, but to stimulate the economy by introducing whole new product lines, products that we don't have now, solar panels on every house, for example,
right,
or big solar concentrators for power plant production. So that's the real change. And another aspect about why that's something that can stimulate the economy is it's not just the founders of those businesses who are going to prosper and grow rich. It's going to create thousands of green-collar jobs as solar installers, energy retrofitters, etc., in our new green economy. Existing products will be transitioning to lower carbon alternatives. One of those we may get to talk about before the program is finished today is transitioning from printed books, magazines, and newspapers to electronic editions of the same things, which some of us are already reading on our computers. But when we have truly effective low-carbon consumption e-readers, then that becomes an even more viable alternative for replacing all that printed matter.
Well, let's just talk about that very quickly, because you tried to do this with your book by making it an e-book. And you've done it. I mean, it's online. You can download it, but you've also you've also chosen to create a printed book as well. Talk about that.
Yeah, the e-books are, some say, on their third life without having been born yet. There have been several attempts to create and market e-book readers in the past that have failed. The current round has been got a big boost from Amazon.com. Just before Christmas last year, Jeff Bezos was featured on the cover of Newsweek magazine with his Kindle, the name Amazon gave to their electronic reader, which is a device about the size of a paperback book, even a little lighter, with most of that space devoted to a screen that displays the text of the book, magazine, or newspaper that you're reading. Unlike a laptop or any current screens we're accustomed to seeing for computers, the screen on this uses a product called e-ink. It's not backlit. There's no light coming from the screen that makes your eyes tired or that makes a wavy picture. It's more like an etch-a-sketch, except extremely sharp and clear, so that once the letters are composed on the page, they stay there. They need no energy during the time you're reading the page. It's only when you flash to a new page that it uses a little bit of electricity. So it's a much, much, much more resource-friendly product than the way we're currently choosing to read.
Well, now, just wouldn't that fall into the category of possible e-waste and how, you know, once you're done with it, it doesn't work anymore, and that whole life? I mean, whereas a book, you could just, you know, use it as kindling, I suppose. Not that I suggest doing that, but, you know, it would biodegrade.
Yep, and that's where a lot of, you know, I go back to the doubt and cognitive dissonance steps in the process on the path to action that we talked about. Many of the recommendations for adopting more lower carbon alternatives to our current practice are countered by somebody who will suggest, sometimes with good intentions and sometimes not, that, oh, but that creates some other problem, and therefore, since there's a problem either way, I'm just going to keep doing what I'm doing. Here, you're exactly right. It will create e-waste, which is a bad thing, as we know, and so it takes a little doing of the math, a little bit of research and analysis to compare the relative trade-offs and benefits.
Okay.
Right now, one of the knocks against an e-book, we have a bit of a chicken and egg problem, or a mass adoption problem, is, and I don't have one, so I'm an example, because if I did, there's a few things I'd read on it, but for the most part, the magazines and newspapers that come through every day, every week, aren't available, aren't suited to the format of reading on that kind of a screen. They're still
right.
The big print, fanfold layout format.
Mm-hmm.
And until they are, the e-reader won't reach its potential, displacing this pounds and pounds, tons and tons of newsprint someone like me reads in the course of a year, in which case it becomes a very efficient alternative. If I read a book or two, no, it's a terrible idea. It's a lot of e-waste, as you say, that could be more efficiently handled by reading a couple of newspapers and books and recycling them afterward.
Right.
But that's where we need to make these big leaps, these big changes that aren't just ones and twos, but they're hundreds and thousands at a time.
Right.
We're not there yet. I did roll it out initially as an e-book to check on uptake and basically confirmed as expected, nope, we're not there yet until people don't want to read on a computer screen if they don't have to, all this extra material. That's
well, you could put it on your laptop if you wanted to.
You could.
Yeah.
And having looked at both, reading on a laptop screen just really isn't the same pleasant experience as reading as a book.
Right.
Or reading from one of these e-readers. I think once we get accustomed to that, that's the same format. It's the same size. It sits in your hands just like a book.
Mm-hmm.
Once you get used to it, it has numerous advantages, including for those of us who are perhaps past our 50th year, you can adjust the type size at the push of a button.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very nice to be able to pump it up a little bit.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to switch topics. I want to go back to a chapter that you have in your book called Being in League with Mother Nature.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to end with this segment of what does that mean exactly? Because, I mean, I feel strongly about it, but I want to hear from you. What do you mean and how is it used in context with climate change?
There's two aspects that are explored in that book. One has to do with what our environmental organizations like Nature Conservancy, Sierra Club, WWF are doing to prepare for the inevitable climate changes that are occurring to help endangered species and natural systems to adapt. So there's stories in there, for example, of the coral reefs, wetlands, natural systems that are highly endangered as the temperature rises, and discovering, for example, in coral reefs, which corals tend to be more resilient than others, trying to assist nature, if you will, to survive and to restore what we have now if the climate changes in the future and later cools again and changes back. The most audacious of these projects is a seed bank.
Right. Yes, I've had Carrie Fowler on the show.
Okay, in
yeah.
Norway, where, you know, sort of worst case scenario if all else fails. With respect to wetlands, the notion is, okay, these wetlands are going to be very wet in the near future as ocean levels rise a bit. First of all, does it make sense to continue trying to preserve wetlands that are currently at sea level, or should we move back from there, go up a little bit, and what could be done to raise the ground level through appropriate planting and irrigation patterns to try to preserve what's currently wetlands further back on the shore, sort of accelerating nature's natural process of retreating inward as ocean levels change. The other part of this is about being in league with Mother Nature is saying, well, you know, Mother Nature could be our ally in combating climate change. And there's a couple examples given. One, of course, is the trees are our friends. They're doing the best they can to remove carbon from the atmosphere.
Right.
Trees, all green things, they thrive on carbon. So that's a good thing if we just leave them alone and preferably help them out. If instead of deforesting the rainforest of the world, we're in fact reforesting the rainforest of the world, it'd be an enormous benefit in reducing the carbon in the atmosphere. Again, more audaciously, the plankton in the ocean performs the same function. There's in fact more plankton in the ocean than forests on dry land. And that plankton has been diminishing over the past few decades for a number of reasons. There are proposals afoot, geoengineering proposals, changing the world on a grand scale to try to artificially stimulate the growth of that plankton to absorb more carbon from the atmosphere and have the same effect as trees. Scientists who've studied this, many are deeply concerned about what the system effects of that would be on the ocean environments. On the one hand, it sounds great. Okay, we'll grow some more plankton, we'll absorb a bunch of carbon, and if you stop there, it sounds really good.
Right.
But if you continue the analysis and say, well, then what happens to all that plankton?
Right.
And therein lies potentially even bigger problems than we have already.
Right.
So
right.
There are prospects for geoengineering. It's another one of those technology will save us possibilities that are held out as excuses for not doing what we need to do to reduce our carbon emissions. But it doesn't sound very promising.
Well, I always think of chaos theory, you know. It's like we just keep putting our hands into everything and you know, somehow it doesn't always work out the best. But we have to, you know, as you say, try different things, at least put them on the table and see how well they work. You know, at one point or another, we're going to come to a solution, whether or not humans are still here. The Earth will align itself. It may just need several hundred thousand years to do it. Chuck, we have a caller. Let's go to our caller. Hi, caller. You're on the air. Who's calling?
Hi, this is Connie from Seaside.
Hi, Connie.
You know, I'm so glad that I listen to this channel, and you guys do so many good things for us. But I want to tell your guest and you that I listened to Tom Hartman this morning.
Yeah.
And after learning about the frozen tundra melting and turning into
methane
mm-hmm. and now listening to you guys, I want to tell you that sometimes I come away just so depressed.
Okay.
And I mean, I just want to cry, and I think, okay, now I drive a Geo Metro. I get more gas than some of these Prius hybrids, and I do the best that I can. I carry around cloth bags. I try to do the best things that I can, and I stumped because I don't know what more to do. I just get exasperated.
Right. No, I hear you, Connie, and it's really sad to think that our world is changing, and you know we're kind of helpless a little
and
bit.
And I'm a brand new grandma. My grandson is just 4 months old, and I shudder to think what's going to happen when my little Alex is going to be raising his family. What's the world going to be like?
Right.
But anyway, I'm so glad that your guest is talking about the things that he is. He's telling me all kinds of good things.
Yeah.
Please continue to do the good work that you are.
Thank
but
you.
Whenever possible, please try to give us answers about what we can do.
Okay, good
Thanks.
Suggestion, Connie. Thanks so much. Any comment, Chuck?
Sure, Connie. You're right on the money with what you're trying to do, and the challenge for all of us is to continue challenging ourselves to do more in the direction you're already going. It's in one sense, it's simple. Reduce consumption, reduce travel.
Mm-hmm.
Especially airplane travel. That's we don't necessarily recognize that it's a tough one to want to have to give up. But airline travel is particularly damaging to the climate because of the altitude at which the carbon is emitted. We need to make better choices, and we need to have better choices to make, the choices that come to us from government, that come to us from business. And we'll get those choices only if enough people like you, Connie, do what you're doing.
Right.
And cause business and government to change what they're offering to us. So just keep at it.
Right, right. Now, do you have just maybe two or three really exceptional things that you would recommend Connie and my other listeners do?
Well, the start and the hard one for many is if you're flying around, you really need to think hard about that. You can produce more damaging carbon emissions in one trip across the country than your annual driving.
Right.
It's a big hit in a big hurry. What you eat matters enormously. Lower on the food chain, the better. Recycle and reuse, the simple stuff we've talked about, the return of frugality, if you will.
Right.
It really does matter. Buying locally, you know, all these things make a real difference. And if you have the opportunity to put solar on your house, that can make the biggest hit.
Right. And what's the thing that you have done? What change have you made in the last month that you are really ecstatic about?
Well, I'm working on the solar process for here, trying to work it out with sustainable roofing materials. I was also appalled by the notion of every 15 years or so, your entire roof goes into the dump. That doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been trying to research the options to put the right surface under the solar panels before putting the solar panels on top.
Ah, very good idea. Well, Chuck, it's been great having you on the show. Tell us your website and how we can reach you if we have more questions or want to get the book.
Sure. The website off the title of the book is astheoceansrise.com.
Mm-hmm.
The book should be available through all booksellers online and conventional. They may not have it in the store, but would be happy to get it for you, and there's contact information for me on the website.
Okay, and of course we would prefer that you purchase the book at a local bookstore rather than going into one of the larger bookstores, just so we can keep our money local. But anyway, thank you, Chuck Tremper, who is the author of As the Oceans Rise, Meeting the Challenges of Global Warming. And I want to also say exceptionally a big thank you to Connie for calling in, because what you were feeling is how a lot of people feel, vulnerable, and I know that it's hard to express that sometimes without, I don't know, getting feeling like you're being inappropriate with expressing your feelings, and it is overwhelming, and maybe we need to address that. So thank you, Connie, as well. So Chuck, have a great day, and thank you so much for calling in, and good luck. I hope this book really helps change some behaviors and bring about the solutions we need. Okay?
Thanks so much for the opportunity.
Okay, take care. And this show has been sponsored in part by Renovations, home of extraordinary design and remodeling. They're proud to being the first green certified business in Carmel Valley. Through sustainable designs, Renovations promises to bring beauty and value beyond expectation on time and on budget, guaranteed. Give Renovations a call at 831-620-1700 or visit Renovations on their website at renovations.net. This program is also brought to you by Monterey Bay Area Green Business Program. Green businesses go beyond recycling to reduce waste, prevent pollution, and conserve both energy and water resources. Shop green for more details and a complete list of green businesses. You can visit them at their website, www.MontereyBayGreenBusiness.org. Again, that's MontereyBayGreenBusiness.org. Tomorrow on Tomorrow Matters, we have Elizabeth Borelli. She's from Nubius Organics. It's an online business selling green.